comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. We publish each and every week a free newsletter. If you're not getting it, you need to subscribe, because if you're not getting it, you obviously haven't got it yet. So get it tonight, okay? Go over to kevinsmithshow.com and click where it says K-Files, K-F-I-L-E-S, K-Files. It's one of the largest links right in the middle of the screen, and I do get emails from people saying, I looked all over your page and I can't find it. well, there it is. Click it and subscribe, all right? The sun has been very, very, very quiet, as you may know. And so quiet that it had astronomers scratching their heads and wondering what's going on. But they predicted that we would be heading into a very, very, very active cycle of the sun. And it seems to have started, because there was early on Sunday morning an explosion on the sun. Now, don't panic. Explosions happen every nanosecond on the sun. But this is what is called a coronal mass ejection. And there was a plasma ejection, a plasma flare aimed directly at Earth. And it hasn't arrived yet, but it will, and it's going to arrive sometime tonight or early in the morning. So we will get to see the effects of it. According to Leon Golub of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, he says, and I quote, this eruption is directed right at us and is expected to get here early in the day on August the 4th. So I guess a little bit past midnight Eastern time, something like that. And he says it's the first major Earth-directed eruption in quite some time. And the article that I'm looking at says, don't worry, we don't expect that there's going to be anything really significant that's going to happen to the Earth, other than we should see the aurora borealis. The aurora usually is seen in the Arctic regions, but they expect this one may be seen in lower latitudes, not just up in the Arctic regions. So you may want to go out and after midnight and sort of, you know, gaze into the sky and see if you can see the arriving plasma from the sun. They say most of this, most of the magnetic particles are captured by the or deflected by the magnetic shield around the Earth. And most of the radiation is diffused and captured in our atmosphere, so it never makes it to the ground. We'll be talking with Stanton Friedman tonight. You want to be sure and be here on the other side of this break. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Now, Stanton Friedman has been my guest on many occasions, and it's always interesting, and always he gives us something to really wrap our brains around and do some thinking over. And I suspect that this is going to be just the same as we talk about a subject that he's written a book about. It's called Science Was Wrong, and that's kind of an amazing title coming from a nuclear physicist, but nevertheless, Stanton Friedman, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're here.
Glad to be on again. Remember, I have a co-author, Kathleen Martin, wrote 7 of the chapters, and I wrote 7 of the chapters, so we each did our thing. We'll probably do another one. More Science Was Wrong.
All right. Well, now, is this not the first book you've written along with Kathleen Martin, is it?
No, we did Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, back in 2007. And Kathleen is Betty's niece, and she has all the tapes, and she did most of the work, let's face it. I came in as the heavy and talked about the star map and the nasty, noisy negativists and stuff like that. But she had, she's trained in sociology, and she looked at all aspects of the case and their life after the experience. She was very close to Betty, especially the last 10 years of her life, lived nearby and so forth. And of course, I had met Betty and Barney way back in 1968. Just a few months before Barney's death in February of 69, and Betty and I did shows together, and I've been in her home and stuff like that, but certainly Kathleen knew her a lot better, and she did some things nobody else has ever done with this story. This isn't the first book, obviously. The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller came out way back in the mid-60s, but he didn't use all the hypnosis tapes. It was a fine book, and it was a bestseller in many different countries. And it came as quite a shocker. I mean, after all, this is the first time somebody had legitimately described a UFO abduction case. There was nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, it was a brand new territory when it came out.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, that you can't say, oh, they just copied somebody else's story. There wasn't anybody else's story to copy. And a very important case, and primarily not only because of the reputations of Betty and Barney. Betty was a social worker, worked for the state of New Hampshire. Barney was on the governor's civil rights commission. He worked for the U.S. Post Office, but he was appointed to the state of New Hampshire Civil Rights Commission. As a matter of fact, they and Kathy went to Lyndon Johnson's inauguration in 64 by invitation. So they were very active in community affairs and had no intention of going public with a UFO abduction account. Somebody broke a confidence. They had taped a little talk that they'd given, and they tried to stop publication. But once the story's out, it's too late, you know. So the new book has a great deal of new information, particularly dealing with the objections of the nasty, noisy negativists. Well, Betty had some dreams, they said, and Barney just echoed those dreams about being abducted and stuff like that. And the trouble is, with that explanation, is that Kathy went through, transcribed all the tapes, the hypnosis tapes, and then it did a comparative analysis of, okay, here's a situation where they were supposedly both together. All the hypnosis sessions were done separately, one-on-one, and they had no way of knowing what the other person was saying. And Dr. Simon, the world-class psychiatrist, hypnotist, induced amnesia after each session, so they had no way of knowing what the other one had said. But when Kathy compared what they said, when they described, for example, when they were in their car and the aliens approached the car, they each described the situation the same way, and it's different from what was in Betty's dreams. And so nobody else has ever done that. And what's funny, it's almost funny, as you might expect, the nasty, noisy negativists grab at any straw they can find. And, you know, Betty and Barney described the object that they observed going in front of the moon. And yet some people insist, oh, it was just Jupiter. When was the last time Jupiter went between Earth and the moon? That would be a neat trick. You know? And others say, well, they watched, Barney watched a show called The Bolero Shield. It was, you know, a science fiction show, and that's where the story comes from. And when you look at the description of the alien in the Bolero Shield and Barney's description under hypnosis, they don't match. You know, and so there's a whole bunch of these things where the stories put out by the debunkers just don't match reality. That's to be expected. There's a long history of this in ufology.
Well, and some of these debunkers wear a DR dot on their name, don't they?
Say that again?
Some of these debunkers wear a DR dot on their name, doctor.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. They have, some have piled higher and deeper degrees.
Yep.
As I call them. And, you know, the chief scientific investigator for what is now called CSI, but used to be called SICOP, Committee for the Scientific Investigation of the Claims of the Paranormal. He has 3 degrees in English. That's real scientific background.
Yeah, there you go.
Explanations don't match the facts, but what the heck? Remember the 4 rules for debunkers, as I put them down anyway. There may be more. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. And I keep running across this stuff. And as you know, I have no qualms about taking on these guys. I've debated on Coast to Coast. I've debated at I was very impressed with the Oxford University Debating Society. And we won that debate, too. It was back in England, of course. And some of those guys are wearing tuxedos, for goodness sakes. Nobody told me about that. I wouldn't have had one anyway.
But, well, let's sort of turn our attention a little bit to how science is wrong about a lot of things. My very open and stated opinion that I think they're dead wrong when they say there's no such thing as UFOs, but they've been wrong about a lot of things. And you've written a book about that. Before we get into that, let me say this. People sometimes hear with one ear or with half their brain. And they hear me say, or hear you say, science is wrong. And they insert the word, all science is wrong.
Yeah.
Or science is wrong all the time. And that's not what's being said. And, science does get it right sometimes. And when they do, they provide tremendous benefit for us all. But they get it wrong sometimes, too.
And the problem is, let me tell you what the original title for the book was.
Okay.
It's impossible, isn't it? The publisher had the right to change it, and change it to science was wrong, I think, because Career Press also published Eric von Daniken's most recent book in the States in English, which was History is Wrong. So now we've got a family of is wrong or was wrong books. And the kicker is, look, I'm a nuclear physicist. I know that science is right a good deal of the time. The problem here, and our focus in the book, is on all those instances where people with all those piled higher and deeper degrees and big positions and stuff stood in the way of progress and delayed the introduction of new technology, led to the deaths of thousands of people in the medical field, And we need to be wary of accepting the proclamation from a so-called expert who has expertise in one area and is talking about another area. You know, when an astronomer talks about airplane travel, and I quote him in the book, Dr. Simon Newcomb, who was the best known, really, American astronomer of the 19th century. And, you know, when he died, as a matter of fact, the President of the United States attended his funeral. That's how important a guy he was. But his proclamation of impossibility really stood in the way of progress, because when a big shot tells you that something can't be done, then it makes it difficult to get support for doing those things, financial support. Let me read what he said, just to give him full credit. Dr. Simon Newcomb: the demonstration that no possible combination of known substances, known forms of machinery, and known forms of force can be united in a practical machine by which man shall fly long distances through the air seems to this writer as complete as it is possible for the demonstration of any physical fact to be. That was stated 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And you notice that word known.
Mm-hmm.
Presuming, what he was presuming was, he knows all that needed to be known to make a decision about this. And my mantra, if you will, is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. And so he made a pronouncement that had no basis in fact at all. Did he know anything about aviation? No. He was an astronomer. What's that got to do with aviation? But when people like that make such pronouncements, well, the Wright brothers got turned down on research grant requests twice. I get a kick out of the fact that on the third time they finally did get a grant after they had flown successfully, and they earned a bonus because the contract, fortunately for them, had a kicker in it. If they flew faster than 40 miles an hour, they could get a bonus. They got a $5,000 bonus because they flew 47 miles an hour. Not very fast by today's standards, but it gives you some idea of how far we've come in a little over 100 years. Their first flight was in 1903 in December. Incidentally, the flight itself was only 112 feet long, first one, and that would fit inside a 747.
But from such small steps come rapid and huge development.
Well, yeah, and the kicker is there had to be guys with guts. And in the book, we also tell the story of Billy Mitchell, a controversial guy. He was quite a successful pilot in World War I. And after the war, for the United States, he was sounding off about how aviation had changed everything when it came to military situations. And he was saying, we'll be sinking ships by dropping bombs from airplanes. And he was laughed like you wouldn't believe. The Secretary of the Navy said, I'll stand on any ship he's going to bomb. He's never going to sink a ship with a bomb. And he was actually court-martialed for being, obstreperous, you know, or not listening to authority. And the sad part about that is there are consequences. And in this case, would you believe that the program for the Army-Navy football game on November 29th, 1941, had a picture of the USS Arizona, this huge battleship. And there was a statement in the article that went with it saying, nobody has ever sunk a battleship from the air. 8 days later, 8 days, the Japanese sunk the battleship Arizona. The number of guys who died was 1,100. But they knew it couldn't be done, so why would you worry about airplanes attacking? They can't sink a battleship. this is what I mean by consequences, in other words.
Well, and, you know, aside from the tragedy involved in that, it would seem that someone would have learned the lesson that it's foolish to assume and to presume that where you're standing is somehow representative both of the future and the rest of the world. You know, the only place that's like where you're standing is where you're standing. And
that's right.
That's true of time as well as space.
Well, yeah, and there are many other examples like this. I mentioned that one just because it dramatically illustrates that there was a price to pay for the short-sightedness. And as a matter of fact, ships had been sunk in the early 20s, Billy Mitchell's people. And the idea that people didn't seem to understand, you didn't need to demolish the battleship with a bomb. All you had to do was hit it hard enough so seams would open up and the water would come in and the ship would sink. You know, it goes down intact almost, except for a few strategic cracks, so to speak. And, you know, maybe you blow up some ammunition while you're at it too. But still, it was a complete misunderstanding. And, you know, the same thing happened in space travel. The British Astronomer Royal in 1956 told Time magazine that space travel is utter bilge. What good would it do? Who would spend the money? It'd be much more important to buy good instruments for astronomers. And, you know, less than a year later, there was Sputnik. And the scientific field that has benefited the most from the space program has been astronomy. All those new devices that can go up above the atmosphere and get around all the limitations that the atmosphere presents and stuff. But there's the British Astronomer Royal. I mean, astronomers have a terrible track record, partly because I think they think that because they know about the universe, and usually what they know isn't quite right, it will change with time, they can make pronouncements about anything. One of my favorite astronomers was a Canadian. I'm a dual citizen of the United States and Canada, so I can complain about both governments, you know, legally. Dr. Campbell, in 1941, calculated the required initial launch weight for a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. There had been a lot of science fiction stories published. Remember the old pulp magazines, you know, about going to the moon? And he said, you know, that's ridiculous, and I'll show you. So his objective was to calculate the required initial launch weight. That's a legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? And pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons.
Stanton, we have to step away for break. It's taking over and our mics are about to go dead. But we'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Stanton Friedman, and I had to cut you off in mid-sentence. You were telling us about the estimate of how big a rocket ship would have to be to get into orbit.
Well, to get the man to the moon.
To get the man to the moon and back, okay.
Yeah, initial launch weight. And so he proceeded to do his calculations, and this was published in a scientific journal, and the thing would have to weigh a million tons. And I will confess that if that was the truth, that would be even too big for me, and I got a big imagination. But when we finally did get three men to the moon, not one, but three, in 1969, with still a dumb old chemical rocket, nothing extraordinary, except for the development. I mean, I have the greatest respect for von Braun and his team. But the initial launch rate was all of 3,000 tons. So instead of 3,000, Hick calculated a million. He was off by a factor of 300 million. The point is that if you make enough stupid assumptions, you can prove anything is impossible. And the kind of assumptions he made I mean, the devil is in the details, somebody once said. I don't know who said that first, but it's true. He assumed a single-stage rocket. Nah, we don't do that. Three stages at least. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration. Well, it turns out the faster you get to orbit, the less energy it takes. Our guys have to stand at least 5 Gs when they're going up. He assumed that when you came back, you better slow down before you land because you're going 25,000 miles an hour. And, you know, that's a pretty good idea. But he assumed the only way you could do that was to fire a retro rocket. Of course, you got to lift that retro rocket from the Earth, slow it down at the moon, lift it from the moon, and then slow it down back here. And we say, hey, that uses way too much energy, way too much propellant. Why don't we get smarter by using the Earth's atmosphere? I mean, it's there. We didn't need to put it there. And if we get the angle right when we're coming back, you may remember Apollo 13. You know, it's pretty clear. You better get the angle right, or you're going to dig a hole in the ground or say bye-bye Earth one way or the other. So being smart's more important than being powerful. He also assumed, for reasons unknown, he was totally unfamiliar with the scientific literature about spaceflight. There'd been Tsiolkovsky, there'd been Hermann Oberth, there'd been Robert Goddard. All kinds of papers had been published, but he didn't seem to be aware of any of them. He assumed that the rocket would have to provide all the energy. He didn't seem to understand that you could use what I call cosmic freeloading. Take advantage of Mother Nature. Man's been doing that for a long time. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you launch to the east when you take off from near the equator, you got a free 1,000 miles an hour head start. That's kind of neat.
Yeah.
If you launch at the right time, the moon will come along and pull you in. That's kind of neat. The moon's very reliable in its motion around the Earth. That's why there's a launch window, so-called. And so all our deep space probes use cosmic freeloading. We've got this Cassini spacecraft out at Saturn, been there for years. I'm proud to say it has radioisotope thermoelectric generators, more than one, on it. A good old nuclear system. We sent it past Venus, which is closer to the sun than the Earth is, to get a free kick, which brought it back past the Earth, where it got another free kick, which sent it past Jupiter, where it got another free kick. Why should we provide the energy when Mother Nature does it for free? Being smart, again, in other words, is more important than being powerful. So we use this technique all the time. It was not the first time anybody had suggested it, but Dr. Campbell knew nothing about such techniques. And so it illustrates, again, the devil's in the details. You better find somebody who knows about this particular area of technology. I mean, just because you're an astronomer and you have a rough idea where the stars are, doesn't mean you know how to get there. You know, astronomers don't build airplanes. They don't build spaceships. And so there's a message here, and it shows up in the medical area as well, where there are consequences. That is, people dying because of the hard-headedness of some of the people in the top echelons. One of my favorite people is Ignaz Semmelweis, a medical doctor in the 1840s or so in Vienna at the Lying-In Hospital. It was the largest in Europe, where women went to give birth. And these were usually poor women. Rich ones could have the midwives come to their homes, of course. And he studied hard and became a doctor, and he observed something, though. The women who were being delivered, their deliveries were done by the midwives, only 2% got childbed fever, which was invariably fatal. Now, this is before we knew, certainly before we had any antibiotics, but before we knew about germs and things like that. And they had all kinds of crazy notions about what would cause this, but in the patients that were being delivered by doctors who would come downstairs from upstairs, they did the autopsies on the women who died the day before, physical examinations of the dead bodies, and then they'd go down and inspect a lot of women in labor and deliver those babies. 20% of those women got childbed fever and died, and the kids died too, incidentally. And a strange accident happened. A friend of his got nicked by a scalpel during the autopsy stuff, and he developed the same condition and died. And so Ignatz, being a smart guy and wanting to treat people and take care of them, instituted strict regulations about washing your hands, using the right kind of soap and using a brush to clean the nails, and adding into that, incidentally, even changing the sheets more than once a month, remarkable as that might sound. And he cut down the death rate from the 20% to the 2%, the same as the midwives had. But he was loud. He published papers. He was strong-minded. You see, at that time, the theory was that the better the doctor, the bloodier his apron. What's this nonsense about washing? You know, this was many years before we realized that you darn well better wash. And so he was actually forced out of the hospital. He was berated by the chief of the hospital, and for the rest of his life, he didn't live to be very old, he was ridiculed. Crazy notions! The fact that he was right didn't matter. He flew in the face of the then-accepted notions by the big shots. It was years later that we finally realized, boy, was he right. And as a matter of fact, a commemorative stamp was issued in the name of Ignaz Semmelweis, and one of the big hospitals was named after him. A little late for those thousands of women who died, incidentally, because of their failure to pay attention to what was pretty obvious when you looked at it.
Well, you know, what happens a lot of times when you get into these debates with, and you've been in a lot of debates, and so, you know, someone throws a name out and they say, oh, Dr. So-and-so said this, and he's a highly respected whatever. Highly respected physician or a highly respected nuclear physicist. But you see, the question then is highly respected by whom and why?
That's right. Does he know anything about the problem at hand? Has he looked at the evidence relative to the problem at hand? And that's what really burns me up about the SETI guys. As you've heard me say before, SETI stands S-E-T-I, Silly Effort to Investigate. They will consistently state there is no evidence for UFOs. Now, I read their books. They don't read mine, of course. Well, Seth Shostak admitted he had a copy of my book on his nightstand. He didn't say he'd read it. This is on Coast to Coast Radio, and I'll be on Coast to Coast again. Incidentally, next Monday, we're going to announce something new and exciting. I'll tell you about it in a little bit. Keep the suspense up. But what I look for with a scientist is, where are your references? What data forms the basis for your conclusions? And you keep looking. I talk about 5 large-scale scientific studies. Seth was there during one of my lectures on the Queen Elizabeth II. I asked how many people have read after I talked about each one of these studies. He didn't raise his hand for any of them. Dr. Jill Tarter will tell you there is no evidence for UFOs. She doesn't reference the 5 large-scale scientific studies and say, oh, but these are worthless. Oh, no. She ignores them. It's as if they didn't exist. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. This is what I find reprehensible.
Well, it's the official position, at least in the documents of the U.S. government, that UFOs do exist.
Well, they'll admit they're UFOs. They're just unidentified flying objects, and when we investigate them, we'll find that they all can be explained as relatively conventional phenomena. And, you know, one of the debates, you mentioned the debates, on Coast to Coast, I was debating with Dr. Michael Shermer, head of the Skeptics Society. We had both been on a Larry King show. He was sitting next to me contributing, well, his major contribution was playing with little alien dolls. you can't believe how many email I got saying, I don't understand why you didn't just punch him out, but that's not my style. Anyway, I challenged him to a debate. George Norrie was on that same show. So we went at it. And he started his commentary. I was shocked, frankly. I had read two of his books in the 2 weeks before, between when I challenged him and when we had the debate. But he started it by saying, look, this is like all these other strange phenomena. There's nothing to it, but there's a 5% residue effect. You never have enough money to explain, enough time, energy, effort to explain everything. So there's 5% that remain unexplained, not because they're spectacular and new and different, but just there isn't enough data. Boy, did that give me an opening. So I quoted chapter and verse at him. A Blue Book Special Report 14, data on 3,201 sightings, largest study done for the United States Air Force. They found 21.5% were unexplainable, completely separate from the 9.3% listed as insufficient information. The Condon Report found 30% unknowns. In the UFO evidence, Richard Hall found that 18% of 4,500 cases could not be explained. And I rattled off a bunch of this stuff. Needless to say, even though we were at it for 3 hours, he got all of 20% of the vote of the audience at the end, and I got 80%. Why? Because he hadn't read anything. He didn't know anything in terms of evidence. He presumed there wasn't any, because if there was, he would have already known it. You know, it's kind of like Bill Nye, the science guy, whose purpose is to deny on Larry King. And I've had people say, they ought to have him on all the time you're on, Stan, because he comes across so poorly.
Well, I think so. I think he does the UFO investigation community a great service. I really do, and I think Larry King ought to have him on every time he does anything about UFOs, because he just does such a great service to the investigation community.
That's a reverse psychology, but I suppose you're right. I got a real kick out of one time. He said, you know, all this stuff about cover-up. Here's a government document which he pulled out.
We'll pick up with Bill Nye when we come back, but the break is taking over, so we have to step away for a couple of minutes, folks, and we'll be back more with Stanton Friedman right after this. Welcome back, and we're talking with Stanton Friedman. And Stan, you were saying something about Bill Nye there.
Bill Nye, the science guy, yeah. On Larry King, he pulls out a document, a single sheet of paper, in which there is a blacked-out line. And he says, look, these guys say there's a cover-up. There's no cover-up. This is a privacy issue. The man's address is here. There's nothing being covered up. We're all entitled to privacy. Fortunately, I had my book Flying Saucers and Science with me and was able to quickly find a page on which there was a typical CIA UFO document that was top secret code word, and on which you could read 8 words. Everything else was blacked out. And so we could put that on camera and show this is the kind of cover-up we're talking about. And it took me 5 years to get this very interesting document with 8 words that you could read. And I also mentioned we have 160 National Security Agency UFO documents that were top secret code word. And the only trouble is you can read only one line, one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out. No cover-up? What is he talking about? But, of course, he hasn't read the evidence, and I got a note from somebody who knew him very well saying that, oh, he normally would spend 5 or 10 minutes on the Internet before he'd do a program like that. And it showed he didn't know anything. And it's aggravating when you see this just because, yes, it is nice that he doesn't know anything. It makes my case stronger, I guess. But I'm out to educate the world, not just to pummel the nasty, noisy negativists.
Well, yeah, but when you've got a guy like him doing nonsense like that, you really get a chance to educate the world. You know, you had the chance to open your book and show that to the TV audience. And that's why I say I think that Bill Nye is the best thing to happen to UFO investigations in a long time.
I guess you're right. But it is, you know, as a scientist who thinks that such subjects merit serious discussion by knowledgeable people, to have one guy who spent 50 years of his life, me, dealing with somebody who might have spent 10 minutes, you know, and getting equal time, it doesn't seem quite right, darn it. You know, it's one of those things. And one of the areas, you know, that there's a chapter in the book about space travel, but it's truly amazing how many dumb things have been said about space travel and are still being said. You can't get here from there. Violates the laws of physics. And, you know, my paper, I gave a paper at the 41st Annual Mutual UFO Network Symposium in Denver 2 weeks ago. And it was called Stephen Hawking, SETI, and Science. And it reviewed some of the stupid things that these guys had said. Smart people saying stupid things about, you know, Hawking said, we shouldn't let aliens know we're here because look what happened to the natives when Columbus showed up. You know, think of that for a minute. We're not like the natives. We got weapons of mass destruction. We got reconnaissance systems all over the place. We have high-speed communications. We're loaded with technology. I don't know. That's the simplest word to use, technology. The natives didn't have any. Didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. But then Columbus wasn't such a hot shot either. What did he have? He had steel and big sailing vessels. Sailing vessels, you know, not exactly the ultimate. And what's truly incredible is the failure of astronomers to recognize that the major source of energy in the universe, which they're well aware of, is nuclear fusion. That's what goes on in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other stars, all of them, they're fusion factories. And you know what? Smart engineers will find a way to use that in a rocket. And it's a little bit more effective than chemical rockets. You can, as a matter of fact, kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. Not 10, not 100, not 1,000, 10 million times. Now, astronomers don't seem to want to think about that. I mean, when the head of the Hayden Planetarium was on the Peter Jennings mockumentary of February 24th, 2005, he talked about our fastest craft, the Voyager spacecraft. It would take 70,000 years to get to the nearest star. He didn't tell you the thing doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's just coasting out there. It's like dropping a bottle in the ocean.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Let me ask you a question about Voyager and others that are coasting out there, because you know we get told about the emptiness of space, the void of space, and all that, and then on the other side, we get told it's full of dark matter. You know, it would seem to me that even though friction would be way way less in space, it would still be there.
It is. The friction is way less. That's why it's nice to have a propulsion system.
So if you just let it coast, eventually it's going to come to a stop, correct?
No, it won't come to a stop because it'll probably be influenced by gravitational fields way out there where that star, once you get away from the solar system, in other words, there are gravitational fields in space. But you ain't going very fast, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a stupid analogy. It's like saying if I put a kite up in the air and let it go, that gives me a handle on how fast you can fly. Well, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. The wind is not is all that's pushing the kite, but there are other ways, like propellers and jet engines and rocket engines, to push a vehicle. And so it's kind of reprehensible when they put such examples up when they're totally misleading. And that's what bothers me. You know, if you want to have a serious discussion, let's have it. But, you know, sometimes we forget how much we've learned in just the last, well, let's say 80 years. Since 1930, let's say. I was born in 34, so I'm saying from, you know, in my lifespan, kind of. And many people don't realize that we didn't realize that there were neutrons until 1932. Oh, there's neutrons all over the place. You and me and the tree and everything else, loaded with neutrons. We didn't know there were neutrons until 1932. And if you're going to have a nuclear chain reaction as in a fission reactor, and there are fission nuclear rockets, I've worked on them. We've tested them. The biggest one, the most powerful, Los Alamos built, and it had a power level of 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam. It was 7 feet in diameter. 7 feet! Grand Coulee Dam's just a mite larger than that, you might have noticed.
Yes, it is.
Nuclear fission is something we know something about. And I mention that because, you know, we've had a nuclear navy since the 50s. Admiral Rickover, thank goodness for people like him with guts, who took on the battleship boys, incidentally. And we've been using nuclear energy for propulsion. Lots of submarines. There's some nuclear-powered cruisers. And what I really like, frankly, is the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. Because they're huge on the one hand, and because they can run for 18 years without refueling. Think about that for a minute. Think how many oilers you'd have to fill with oil to power that for 18 years, you know. And so this isn't new, in other words. It's not something that Friedman is dreaming up. It's the real world in which we live, and it's been going on for a long time. And so you'd think they would understand that there's something besides combustion, you know, like in cars, or in jet engines, or in with the use of propellers and so forth. We can use nuclear energy to produce power and propulsion systems, and submarines can go around the world underwater without surfacing, the whole way around the world. That's not imaginary. That's the way it is. And there's not just one country. The United States isn't the only country with nuclear-powered submarines. Soviets have them, and the French have them, and the English have them. So the lack of connection with the real world is what bothers me. And get back to the SETI cultists again. This year, there have been a lot of nice things said about aliens. All, not about UFOs, you understand, but about aliens. I mean, when Stephen Hawking speaks, people listen. There was a big meeting of the Royal Society in London.
Stan, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up with Stephen Hawking when we come back. Shortly thereafter, folks, we'll open the phone line so you can join us. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, and Stanton, again, we had to cut you off in mid-sentence, so the floor is yours.
Okay, I'm not even sure where I was when we did that, but...
I'm not either.
the problem here is when we start talking technology, and this past year, a lot of good pleasant comments about aliens. They may have been wrong, but at least they weren't nasty or ha-ha-ha kind of thing. And this conference at the British Royal Institute was because of the 50th anniversary of Frank Drake's initial attempt to listen for signals from another solar, from another star, a planet around another star. We didn't know if there were any planets there, but we were listening to that general area. And, of course, at that time, we didn't know that there were planets outside our solar system. We hoped. And now we've found 470 plus a whole slew more from the Kepler spacecraft. But anyway, Frank has concluded, using the famous or infamous Drake equation, which purports to show how many civilizations there are in our solar, in our galaxy, capable of sending signals to us. Now, what he doesn't add is, of course, they have to be using techniques that are appropriate for our technology, even though we've only had radio for a little over 100 years. Now, how would they know what our technology was that we could receive and interpret and translate, if you will, their signals? That's an interesting question. And but Frank concludes there's 10,000 civilizations in the galaxy, planets where you can send signals from. Now, the kicker is, in the first place, there's over 100 billion stars in the galaxy, so that means that only 1 in 10 million of those stars has a planet capable of sending signals to us. That means within approximately 1,000 light years, there would be only two such civilizations, even though there's, what is it, 16 million stars in that region. Boy, are we lucky to be one of the special ones. But the Drake equation doesn't consider anything like colonization, migration, and yet every advanced civilization is going to know not only how its star works, which means they'll know about nuclear fusion. We figured it out in 1938, incidentally. But they're also going to know that there may be a time when you need to move your civilization a little bit, maybe a supernova. Maybe an asteroid clobbers you. Maybe there's a nuclear war. Maybe you beat the heck out of the planet, so you better go someplace else where things are a little better. So they're always going to be looking around for other places. And, you know, one of my favorite pair of stars.
Before you go on, we're doing that very thing right now with Kepler.
We're trying to find out what's out there, yeah. And there is a misconception that people have asked me, well, when are they going to look at Zeta Reticuli, Stan? You like that place. That's from the Betty and Barney Hill experience. Well, it can't. Kepler is in a very elongated orbit around the Earth, and it's looking at a small chunk of the sky. You can visualize it by taking your two hands out in front of you, two hands side by side at arm's length. We just cover the region of the sky that it's looking at. And you're trying to keep away from looking anywhere near the sun, of course, because this is a very delicate, I forget, it's got 90 megapixels for the camera. It's the largest digital camera ever put in space. It's quite remarkable and extraordinarily sensitive, and it works on the basis of transits. That is, planets around another star going in front of the star absorb a little of the light and change the frequency of the light that goes by it just a bit, so you can get some handle on the mass of the star and the period of time it takes to go around the star, the mass of the planet and the period around it. And they've found that there are a lot of rocky small planets, which came as a big shock to some people because they've been finding big ones. Why? Because they're easiest to find. They're bigger. Your instruments don't need to be so sensitive, but boy, is Kepler sensitive. It's an incredible. Kepler was a great scientist way back a few hundred years ago, and it's appropriate to name this after him, but it's revolutionizing what's going on. It's going to last for maybe 3 years, probably longer than that, and it is truly exciting. Somebody said the sensitivity was like spotting a flea going in front of a automobile light a mile away.
You'd have to have a pretty sensitive instrument for that.
Yeah. And so I think the place is loaded with planets. We know that already. And it's also loaded with places capable of sending signals. But I can't imagine any reason, and maybe some of your listeners can, why in the world would an advanced civilization someplace else, and remember, it's almost certainly got to be more advanced than we are because we've only had radio for roughly 100 years, and the planet's been around for 4.5 billion or so, and the galaxy for maybe 13 billion years. So it's hard to imagine we're at the leading edge of technology in that, in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to imagine why would they send signals to us? What for? And why would they think we could interpret them? I mean, you know, going back to the natives and Columbus, several people said over the last few months that if aliens were coming here, they'd have sent a signal. We haven't picked up any signals, so they must not be coming here. Sure, Columbus sent smoke signals to the Indians, didn't he? Telling them that, have dinner for 26? It's ludicrous. They're doing their thing out there, but I think there's a lot of them out there. And to think there's only 10,000 in our galaxy, I'd say 10 million, 10 billion is much more reasonable. And some have come and gone. There have been disasters and stuff. We're just at the beginnings of some understanding of the neighborhood, of Mother Nature. As I said, we only discovered the neutron in 1932. DNA is less than 60 years old that we knew about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is one of the things that I've said many times. It applies to various principles and laws in medicine, but it specifically has to do with the laws of physics. There aren't any laws of physics. They simply are not there. What we're calling laws of physics are really descriptions of our own current understanding of how it works. But that's subject to change as our instruments get better.
We might learn something new that we don't know at all. How dare you?
Stan, I'd like to include our audience and start accepting some calls. Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number here in the studio is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number for the USA and Canada is 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can either call our main number, and we'd love to hear from you, and it'll work anywhere on the planet. Or you can go to my website, scroll down, and you'll see a link that says Flash Message, and you can use that because I don't have a international toll-free number for you. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hi. Mr. Stanton, you were talking about, a signal. That guy, Kanaki, he does the science show. He's a Chinese or Japanese gentleman. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Are you talking about Michio Kaku?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Michio Kaku. Right. I've been on his radio show, as a matter of fact.
He stated that which I found very interesting is we're looking for a signal, something we would understand and be pointed towards us and we could pick up. But he said something that was really interesting that a real advanced alien civilization, if they wanted to contact somebody from other galaxies, that they would use the entire bandwidth, from A to Z, and to transmit a signal, and that we wouldn't, and us listening would never be able to pick it up at all. We wouldn't ever understand it until we could do that.
Yeah, Michio is quite correct that it's not very likely they're going to use a technique which is compatible with what we are doing with our very, very, very short history of being able to receive radio signals from outer space in the first place. And, you know, the simple question, are they sending digital or analog? We're using analog, by and large. If they're sending digital signals, we ain't going to pick them up. But, of course, Michio also said that if they were coming here, they would have sent us a signal. We would have gotten a signal first, and that, to me, doesn't make much sense. But he was more open about methods of warping space and time and traveling to distant places, which I found interesting, as opposed to the other SETI people who can't even imagine that anybody could travel because they don't know how to travel, so nobody else does. You know, it's the kind of crazy thinking you get. But, yeah, we're going to learn.
In here. If I can
say that,
I just wondered. It seemed like pretty much right after, you know, we got into atomic age and got atomic bomb. It seemed, you know, it wasn't long before we was able to make small enough nuclear reactors to power our ships. I mean, how was that done? You know, it seemed like it. You know, it's, you know, we got the bomb and then all of a sudden we got nuclear. Ships, you know, we was able to downsize.
Well, it's a natural progression. As part of our effort to make plutonium, we were looking at two different ways of building atomic bombs, using uranium-235, which means you got to enrich natural uranium, which only has 0.7% uranium-235. The rest is 238, and you want to make the bomb out of 235. So we built a plant in Oak Ridge that is a mile long and was using 5% of the power of the United States to power pumps to pump uranium hexafluoride, a gas, through these little holes in a nickel membrane. And because one of the isotopes is a little heavier than the other, it goes through slower. And by the time you get finished, you will have enriched, and you put the stuff back in again and do it again. The other approach was to use plutonium. Now, to make plutonium, you have to operate a big nuclear reactor, and you have uranium-238, which captures a neutron and becomes neptunium, which then becomes plutonium. So you have to cool this reactor, and these are at Hanford, Washington, and these were made during the war, and so we were building big reactors. They weren't producing power for anybody else. They were producing plutonium. It was a major effort, to say the least. But it wasn't very long after the war that Admiral Rickover started looking at building more compact reactors using uranium enriched in U-235, but not fully enriched as you'd need for a bomb. You'd like about 90% U-235. For a nuclear power plant, you only need about 2%. So we were doing that, and because we had a bunch of guys working on the project, they built reactors at other places, and by the end of the 50s, we'd built a power reactor, we'd built nuclear submarines. Now, the aircraft carriers didn't come along until much later. They're big old things, and you better have reliability if you're going to depend on it for 18 years, and it takes a lot of power. An aircraft carrier is big, a submarine is small. But I was working on nuclear-powered airplanes, or trying to, way back in 1958. And we did experiments at reactors. I was running radiation shielding experiments at reactors at Oak Ridge and Convair Fort Worth, out in Idaho. And our program was not a little program. I mean, you don't do this with six professors and 18 grad students. General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in 1958, we spent $100 million that year. We employed 3,500 people full-time, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. And it may not seem like a lot of money, but $100 million is a lot of money in 1958.
In today's dollars, it would be just over $1 billion.
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1 year. So there was a lot of work going on, and I started work there in 56 until 59, and there were lots of reactors around. And so if you spend enough money and you have enough people, And many Americans are unaware of how big the nuclear weapons-related labs are, for example. Los Alamos, Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, three nuclear weapons labs. I checked about 5 years ago, and they each employed more than 8,000 people. They each had an annual budget of more than $1 billion. The total for the three was greater than all the research and development budgets of the National Science Foundation. And I mentioned that because I had a strange argument made to me recently that if Roswell had happened, half the physicists in academia would have had to go to work to find out what was going on there. And I said, you've got to be kidding. We had all these labs that were built during the war. You have to send materials for examination to people who have security clearances, to have sophisticated equipment, the ability to store classified material, and need to know for high security stuff. Those were all in place. We didn't need anybody from academia. Those who can do, those who can't teach. Those who can't teach gym, you know.
Let's go back to the telephone and caller. You are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Stanton, I have a question for you. I know it's a little out of your field, but I'm going to ask your opinion on it anyway. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are approaching the edge of the solar system. But what they're discovering is that they're veering away from the edge of the solar system. I don't know what the angle is. Now,
and we don't know why.
My question is it possible that there is a magnetic bubble around our solar system? And if that magnetic bubble exists, would it reflect most, if not all, of our radio signals back at us?
It wouldn't do that, but it would have an enormous impact on the solar system. There's a chapter in the new book, Science Was Wrong, about how important magnetic fields are in the solar system. On the sun, the solar storms, the sunspots, the Van Allen belts, the radiation from Jupiter. 50 years ago, people were saying, well, there's no effect of magnetic fields in the solar system. It's all gravity. What are you talking about? Now we know that, it turns out that the magnetic fields are extremely important. And it's not clear exactly how much effect they have on the Voyager spacecraft. That's still a puzzle we're working on. But tell you one thing, we're certainly finding that the sun is not the constant source of energy we used to think it was. That, as a matter of fact, we've got a couple of special satellites up there studying the sun. And boy, that's a cauldron of huge prominences and incredible magnetic fields. I mean, this is what produces the aurora on Earth, but it does all kinds of other things. And in the book, you might be interested, I tell the story of a guy named Nelson who worked for RCA, and his job was to figure out when they could get by using radio signals as opposed to using landlines, because it costs money for landlines to transmit signals and stuff. And he used a method that depended on the positions of the planets. And he was better than 90% accurate. And it turns out that the position of the planets determined the center of gravity of the solar system, which is not in the middle of the sun, because when you got Saturn and Jupiter, for example, on the same side of the sun, the center of gravity has moved over that way a little bit. When they come unglued, so to speak, then it moves someplace else. Well, changes in the position of the center of gravity produce some of these storms, stimulate these incredibly powerful releases of energy. And I know some people are going to say, he's talking astrology. No, we're talking about scientific observations that the solar system is a very dynamic magnetohydrodynamic, electromagnetic, call it what you want, system. And so, yes, we're having a little trouble understanding, so how come they're not where we thought they should be at this time? Is the force of gravity decrease in time or with distance from a sun or whatever? Another little mystery. But it's fascinating to see how suddenly we realize that Even global warming seems to be related to electromagnetic fields, and there's a periodicity in them. 11 years is the period, and you know what? That's the period of Jupiter around the sun.
Well, that's interesting.
There's a chapter in the book about this, and it's quite fascinating. And there's a great Russian study that shows periodicity, and also a study of dendrochronology, where you do very careful work on tree rings. And you find that the important effect is the galactic cosmic ray level, not the temperature of the planet. Isn't that amazing? So we're beginning to realize what babes in the woods we are, even though we were told that we know all about this kind of stuff 50 years ago. Science was wrong. Not surprising.
Not surprising. All right, we have a break coming up, and let me see. Caller, are you willing to hold on through the break?
Sure.
All right, you hang in there, and right after this break, we will get to you. We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and we intend to continue talking with Stanton Friedman on the other side of this break. Now, I'll tell you what. My apologies to both of you, because the clock on the computer is off by 2 minutes. And I have two computers, and the one on the left is working. The one on the right is wrong. So we have 2 minutes till break. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Kevin, this is Ryan in Washington.
Hello, Ryan.
Well, maybe we had a small case of missing time there or something.
I don't know. It's weird stuff happens once in a while, and you have to reboot the computer. But that particular clock is off by 2 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not even a scientist, and it could take. It doesn't matter who you are. If you look at SETI, you can tell that the whole thing is the idea is it's so stupid that. It's amazing that some of the SETI people say that, well, you can't get there from here, but then they're relying on radio signals. Well, how the hell will radio signals get here from there? That's what I don't understand. If it can't get here from there, then why are they looking for radio signals, which would never get here from there? But anyways, Stan, I was wondering when you were looking into the Betty and Barney Hill case, I was wondering, had any of their friends or people that they knew in the military or other people, have they all been interviewed? Is there any other witnesses that was ever found that saw the thing that they saw?
No, there weren't really other witnesses. There was a Project Blue Book report. Remember, this is in the middle of the night, so to speak, in rural New Hampshire in 1961. And there was a Blue Book report. And remember also, they didn't know that they'd been abducted. There was a missing period of time of 2 hours.
Now the break's taking over. So we'll get the rest of that answer when we come back, and I'll make a note so we'll remember where we left off. Ryan, thank you so much for the call. Folks, we shall return with Stanton Friedman on the other side of this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Stanton Friedman. We're going to take this call, but we'll caller, you're on hold, and just hang on a moment. And Stan, do you want to continue where you left off?
Yeah, just briefly, that the caller was wondering, can you get signals and not people? And the SETI people know that you can get radio signals from all over the place. It's one of our windows on the world. What they don't understand is you can move things, rockets, people, big rockets, small rockets, etc., using things like nuclear fusion, which can give particles 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. But they don't know anything about advanced propulsion systems. They think we're stuck at the level of radio. I mean, I don't use slide rules anymore. We've gone beyond that in my lifetime. And I think everybody out there realizes that their computer would have been incredibly valuable 50 years ago.
Sure. Yeah.
We didn't have anything like that. It was impossible, incredible, you know. And we quote, there's a chapter in the book, Science Was Wrong, about communications and technology of general sort, and the people who thought, you know, there wouldn't be a need for more than half a dozen big computers, and why would anybody need a computer at home? And, you know, there are all kinds of silly statements that were made by people who were looking backwards and not forwards.
Well, again, with SETI, you know, a lot of people, I say this and a lot of people disagree with me, and you may, I don't know, it's okay if you do. But, you know, I think it's ridiculous to be looking for radio signals at any frequency, because if they're traveling at or near the speed of light, and if I'm talking about the spaceships coming here, if they're traveling at or near the speed of light or exceeding the speed of light, radio signals would be way too slow for them. And, you know, they're using some other form of communication, and or a level of radio signals that we don't know anything about, that are not bound by the speed of light, and that's hard for us to imagine because our laws of physics say it can't be.
Well, the laws don't actually say that. The laws say as you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for things moving that fast. So it, pick a number, 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go a distance of 37 light years in 6 months pilot time, not 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
But people want half an Einstein. You know, we accept the one part, but we forget about the other part because it's inconvenient for us to realize that, oops, of course they can get here from there.
Yeah, but I think radio signals would be way too slow for them. Our radio signals would be. All right, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say radio signals move at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
Electromagnetic radiation is the same, whether it's radio or light or whatever. But go on, you got somebody calling on you.
Yeah, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, it's John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Stanton.
Hi.
Hi. What I'm hearing is, with all these examples of people in the top of the hierarchy and then sounding foolish or... to me, it's related to the Peter Principle.
Rise to your level of incompetence?
Yeah, except there is a difference. The Peter Principle relates to a well-defined hierarchy within, say, a corporation or a scientific establishment, and they're promoted to a specific position, and you know they're incompetent because they hit a point where they're not performing very well. Now, the difference here is the position is self-defined, so it's kind of a double irony when that happens. It's, you know, they define their position where they think they have an authority, even though it's, you know, chances are it's not in their area. So it's self-defined, and they're defining their own level of incompetence, except they don't know it. So I find that kind of amusing and interesting at the same time.
Stanton, are you still with us? I thought I heard a click.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we get him back online, let me throw this out and ask you what you think about this. They, these scientists that you're talking about, have believed a fiction, and that is they have believed the concept of impossible. And that's fiction. Everything that ever will be possible has always been possible. It's just waiting on people to think the right thoughts. Let's see if we can get Stanton back online here. his line is still busy, so he and I were cut off, but it didn't show on his side, I guess. But as soon as we can get him back on, I'll get his comments about the Peter Principle. Let's give it another try. Well, all we get is a busy signal, so maybe his phone line has been interrupted, or maybe he's still hanging on. I don't know. But as soon as we can get him back.
Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, just mentioning the Peter Principle, do you think that set off some alarms somewhere?
Well, it may have. You know... I don't know. But what's interesting is the kind of busy signal we're getting is the really fast one. That means it's not his line that's busy, but the exchange that's busy. So maybe he got interrupted at the exchange. But I doubt that it's something black ops or nefarious or anything like that. It may be weather-related.
Let me mention one or two things. Like, have you had Paul Laviolette on?
No, I have not.
Well, because he's talked about the superwave theory and superluminal travel, he says, is possible. And he's a physicist, and he talks about this. And so when I hear SETI people say, well, you know, it's not possible, we've already got physicists with very good physics talking about and demonstrating and with mathematics that faster than light travel is possible already. So...
Well, and we'll get Stanton's back with us. We'll get him to comment on this. But, you know, the idea that there's no speed faster than light has been proven to be wrong. And we now have instruments, although we cannot observe ourselves anything faster than the speed of light, instruments can. And there is a pulsar that is undergoing a polarity change, in other words, a pole shift, and it's undergoing it constantly at six times the speed of light. So there are speeds faster than the speed of light, but Stanton, I think what you said is that it's not even necessary to exceed the speed of light.
Right.
If you're at 99.9% the speed of light, then, you know, you can travel the universe.
Well, the big Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, over in Switzerland, the particles there are moving 99.99999% of the speed of light, or they will be when it's going full tilt. It's a little less than that now. Only four nines instead of five, but so you know it's the real world out there. And incidentally, you have to take this time shrinkage, if you will, slowing down for things moving fast, into account when you build accelerators and when you examine what happens with Mother Nature's super fast cosmic rays. Mother Nature still outdoes man, incidentally, much more powerful particles, and when they hit the top of the atmosphere and create new particles and stuff. By the time they get to the bottom of the atmosphere, time dilation is very important. It's real. But the kicker here is these guys are in a time warp. The SETI people are thinking about chemical rockets. Why, I have no idea, but it's not their area of expertise. And remember, something we haven't talked about, if aliens are visiting Earth, who needs SETI? Maybe learn sign language, you know. it makes no sense. They've got to protect their jobs and their future. And if they start looking at UFO evidence, wow, there goes the nice cushy jobs. You pass the job on to your kids, for goodness sakes. I've been looking, and I'll keep looking, and I'm going to save the world by finding contact with aliens sometime. Just wait. Wait a while. Wait a little longer. Wait a lot longer. I mean, when you start looking at it from an outsider's viewpoint, you say, this is ridiculous. That's why I use the term cult in Flying Saucers and Science. I talk about the cult of SETI. How do you characterize a cult? It's got charismatic leadership. So Carl Sagan, Seth Shostak, Jill Tarter, these people are charismatic. I'm not saying they're not. They're bright people. Strong dogma. And the dogma is very straightforward. There are aliens out there. They're sending signals that we can pick up with our equipment because they're good enough to do that, you know, instead of sending something we can't pick up. And we just wait a while and we'll pick up those signals. Part of the dogma is you can't get here from there. We don't need to worry about aliens visiting. There aren't any aliens visiting. That's the dogma. So when you start looking at that, then it does begin to sound like a cult. Oh, also, cultists have a strong feeling about how important they are. You know, call it the Jim Jones effect, if you will. And I'm not drinking any of that Kool-Aid, I'll tell you that.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin Stanton. It's Brian from Burnaby.
Hello, Brian.
Yes, I was just wondering, even if you had a fusion-style rocket, you would still need to throw a mass out the back, wouldn't you?
Well, yes and no. If you use the right stuff like deuterium and helium-3, deuterium is heavy hydrogen, helium-3 is light helium, if you react those, you get all your energy is produced in the form of very energetic charged particles that have 10 million times as much energy as you can get in a normal chemical rocket. So you're kicking stuff out the back, but boy, what a difference between that and a chemical rocket where you have a few electron volts. Now you're talking about 18 million electron volts of energy.
All right, we have to step away for a break. Brian, do you want to hang on?
Sure.
All right. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and we have on the line with us Brian from Burnaby as well. And Stanton, you were talking about this difference in energy that you're kicking out the back.
Well, yeah, and let me illustrate. In a Canadian reactor, a heavy water moderated natural uranium CANDU reactors, one fuel bundle, which is about 2 feet long and about 44 pounds, 20 kilograms, produces as much energy when in the reactor as burning 400 tons of coal. That's four coal cars. So it gives you some idea that nuclear reactions involve one heck of a lot more energy. E equals MC squared, remember that? Well, it does, if you figure out how to tap it. And so even Einstein and Lord Rutherford, two pioneers in the nuclear field, didn't realize that there would be a way that you could control nuclear reactions, fission as being one and having a pile, a nuclear reactor. So with fusion, it's even more energy than the fission thing. And because you're using isotopes of hydrogen and helium, it's kind of nice to know that hydrogen and helium, the two most abundant elements in the universe. Wherever you go, you're going to find that. You may have trouble finding uranium, incidentally. We have a dense planet here, Earth, but and uranium is almost twice as dense as lead, so you got to have a dense planet to find some uranium. But hydrogen and helium, they're everywhere, fortunately, for the fusion brigade. I worked on a study of fusion propulsion way back in 1962. What does that make me feel old? But we are making progress on fusion. The point is that within 1938, we figured out it was fusion that makes the sun work. 1952, we proved it by building our first H-bomb. And to give you some idea, it produced as much energy as exploding 10 million tons of TNT. 10 million tons. Now, a big bomb during World War II was a 10-ton blockbuster. 10 tons. This is 10 million tons, and you can still carry today's H-bombs in an airplane. So what we have to recognize is it's a whole other ball game. It's like the slide rule in a computer. Today's computers, not yesterday's.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to be realistic and say, look what's going on here.
So if we can figure out a way to control the fusion and make it portable enough, we can use it for spacecraft. Brian, does that answer your question?
Yes, I did. I had a bit of a follow-up. I remember Major Kehoe was writing of rocket-like flying saucers, and I think Lonnie Zamora and others had rocket-like characteristics. Most of them from the 50s and 60s did. Now, the later saucers, you don't hear all that much about rocket exhaust of whatever sort
no.
of power they have. And I was just wondering how that works out.
The kicker is we have to separate the question of propulsion into how do you get here from another star and then how do you flit around in the atmosphere. And there I go back to my nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that can go 18 years without refueling, and it's a huge monster, and it carries 75 little airplanes that can go, 2 hours if you're lucky, without refueling. They have different characteristics because different applications. We have a number of excellent reports, including from out your way, the Yukon, for example, not too far from you, of huge motherships, for want of a better phrase. One over the Yukon, 30-some observations, and a civil engineer named Martin Jasek, who lives in B.C., was able to triangulate and discover that that old thing was someplace between 0.6 and 1.2 miles long. When you look at crash saucers, such as at Roswell or Aztec and a few other places, you're talking about little guys. Even the Hill UFO, Betty and Barney Hill, that was under 100 feet in diameter. The motherships are big and probably use a somewhat different process because they're performing a different function. They don't crash, apparently.
All right, Brian, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. I want to very quickly read a flash message from Leonardo in Puerto Rico. Hello, Kevin. Hello, Mr. Stanton. Good show tonight. I believe there's life everywhere, especially intelligent civilizations, but even though our government deny there are extraterrestrial life, there is extraterrestrial life, they are, in fact, in contact with them. I've read that there's a space naval command and that there is a colony on Mars since the 1980s and that the moon is being mined. What do you think? You have to keep it brief, though, Stanton, because I've got another one before we hit the end of the show.
It's in my gray basket, maybe. I haven't seen data to say it's true, but I can't prove it isn't true. I discuss some far-out questions like that at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You can get all the books with appropriate autographs, even when there are two authors. We both autographed all the books. But there are a lot of things we don't know, and there are a lot of stories like that one, the Serpo story and others. And all I can do is throw up my hands and say, I don't know. Show me some evidence. Don't tell me stories.
Yeah.
Stories are interesting, but evidence is more important.
All right, from Davey in the United Kingdom. Hello, Kevin and Stanton. Stanton, what is your take on quantum entanglement with regard to you can't get there, can't get here from there scenario, in that chemicals, water appears to communicate instantaneously without chronological time involved? What do you think about that?
It's a very exciting area. I don't know enough to predict what its future will be, but certainly it would have been thought impossible, 10 years ago, maybe? 15 years ago? That's why the book was going to be, It's Impossible, Isn't It? And the answer often is, well, no, it's not. Impossible. So there is quantum entanglement. Whether this will lead to traipsing around the local galactic neighborhood, I don't know. I'm not a psychic. There's a whole chapter on psychic phenomena and Science Was Wrong, and there is a lot of evidence to say that there are some psychic things going on. So, you know, that's exciting.
All right. We're just about out of time. Let me remind everyone that, as always, if you click our guest photograph, it will take you to his website. All right. Which, by the way, has been redesigned, and I like it, Stanton.
Well, I'll tell my webmaster he did a good job, and I was very pleased. I'm an old stick in the mud, but he brought me forward into the 21st century.
It's easy to navigate, and there's lots of information there. And it's attractive, pleasing to the eye. I like the change. So be sure and tell him that. And, folks, be sure you click on Stanton's photograph, and that'll take you over to his website. But if you forget to do that, just remember his name, StantonFriedman.com. All right, StantonFriedman.com.
That's me.
Stanton, we've got less than a minute here. Are you going to be appearing in any conferences or anything real soon?
Yeah, there's going to be the Coast to Coast Radio next Monday night, put in a plug, talking about a new thing, a movie called Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C, and you got to tune in to find out about it. That's exciting. And also...
When you're on his show, be sure you put in a plug for mine.
I'll try to do that.
All right.
I'll be in Exeter, New Hampshire. These are all listed on my website. And I'll be in Angel Fire, New Mexico, and I'll be in Burlington, Wisconsin, and in Virginia Beach, and Stroudsburg, France. That I'm excited about. And it looks like I'll be in, would you believe, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia in January.
I do believe, because we have audience there, and in the UAE and all over the Middle East, we've got audience. Stanton, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for being my guest this evening. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for just a moment, and I'll speak with you after we are off the air. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.